Jackie, whenever you're ready.
I'm ready.
Ready?
I was born ready. Hey, are you ready?
I'm ready.
All right.
Hi, podcast listeners. It's Andrew Hahn from Brian Windhorst and the Hoop Collective. On this episode, Jackie McMullen sits down with Dennis Rodman for a one-on-one conversation in advance of his 30 for 30 documentary, Rodman, For Better or Worse. Rodman talks about his childhood, his playing days, and his struggles with trying to be a good father. This is the audio version of the full interview that you can find on ESPN's YouTube page. Also, Jackie has a written piece that you can find on ESPN.com. Now, here's Jackie McMullen and Dennis Rodman.
So, I've known you a long time, and I thought I knew almost everything about you.
Almost.
And I was wrong. I did not know a lot of things about your childhood and how you grew up.
Right.
And I'm wondering, like, how you survived a lot of that.
I really don't remember some of my childhood. I think a lot of people remind me of some of the things I've done when I was young. But not too many people. You know, I really don't talk to my mother that much. Obviously,
right.
You've probably seen the documentary. You know, my sisters, I don't talk to them as much. But if anything, has to do with my childhood. I really don't know too much about it because it just came and went.
But sometimes there's damage that comes from that period of your life, right? That you carry with you, all of us.
Well, it's difficult because when you live in a situation like that, like most athletes in the 60s, mm-hmm. Most kids in the 60s and early 70s, you really don't have any direction, even any avenues to explore.
Right.
You know, because your mindset is more like what you do in your surroundings. And living in a project in the ghetto, it's more like for fun, you pretty much go and kick rocks, play jacks, play hopscotch with rocks. Anything that has to do with dirt or rocks, we had to play with because we had no toys and stuff like that. I think a lot of people will see this interview and say, I relate to that, you know, because that was our outlet to enjoy something that was fun. But if you take yesteryear, the 60s to now, it's just a whole different. I mean, who would imagine that a person like me or anyone that's in the sports figures that lived in the 60s become this from the 60s to this? No one. I didn't think I thought I would be in jail. I think I'd be a drug dealer or be dead. That was my options. There was no option to go play video games. There was no option to go work at a Jack in the Box, McDonald's. There was no option back then for anyone. So basically, our outlet was to rob and steal or be a drug dealer. So there was no mindset for me to try to think of any other way to get out.
But you did. You did get out.
Well, it was different, though.
It was
difficult to get out. Under the circumstances.
So one of the things I didn't know was I knew when you were young that your dad wasn't around.
Yeah, that's I can't recall anything about him or whoever he is. I saw him one time in my life.
What was that one time?
That one time was in the Philippines, I think 4 years ago. The first time I saw him.
Not necessarily
the second time I saw him. I saw him in Chicago in 1997. We was playing, I think, Utah Jazz. And I was going to practice at the Bertel Center. And I was late. And I was going in to get into the gate. And this black guy runs up to my truck. And I'm like, he's trying to talk to me. He said, I need to talk to you. I said, dude, I'm late for practice. He said, I just want to let you know that I'm your father. I mean, just out the blue. And I'm like, oh, come on. I got to deal with this stuff today. I couldn't even focus. I said, you know what, dude? I'm late for practice. I'll talk to you later. And I think it's just a fan coming to me, just trying to reach to me. And I go to practice. I didn't even think about it. When I went to practice, I didn't even think about it. I said, oh, whatever. So I come out of practice. I get back in my truck, and this guy runs back to my truck and said, I'm your father. You know, and I said, I don't care, man, whatever you think. So I go home, then get ready for the game for the night's game. We get to the game, we're playing a team, so we go I'm playing a game, then all of a sudden they call a timeout. I'm walking back to the bench, and I happened to look up, and I said, wait a minute, what's going on up there? He said, dude, that's your father up there. And I said, who? Your father. My dad. I'm like, all right, whatever. He said, no, he's just up there signing autographs and doing interviews. And I'm like, all right, great. I'm still thinking it's like a host. And I'm like, all right, great. So when the game was over, I went back to the locker room, and the reporter said that, did you know your father was here? I said, nope. Did you know that he wrote a book about you? I said, nope. Did you know it was a bestseller? I said, nope. I'm like, still, like, I think it's still a big joke because this guy came out of blue and said he's my father. I'm like, never seen this guy before. And,
But how does that make you feel? This guy that was never there for you, now you're a multi-million-dollar athlete and he's signing autographs and writing books?
Writing books, yeah. I think if you get in depth with his story, I think he has like 16 wives. He has 16 wives. I think 49 kids, and I was the first one. Supposedly, I was the first one. And I didn't know that until somebody told me. And it is funny, though, how this parallels in my life, right. You know, as growing up. You know, if we get to it, and we get in depth with this, and it's, you know, if we going around the board with my upbringing. But it's a trip that, you know, that this guy is coming to say he's my father. I've never seen this man. And he's saying that, you know, I just want to say hello to you. I'm like, whatever. You know, so I'm so used to not having a father after 37 years, you know.
It's a little late.
It's a little late, right? So.
Wow. That's terrible.
I'm not terrible. I was used to it.
But the fact that you're used to it is, I think, the thing about this documentary that really struck me was you just wanted someone to like you, right?
It's so funny that you said it, Jackie. Every interview I did yesterday, and it's like, that's the only thing that hurts me. That's the only thing that anyone can say about me. Can't even do this goddamn interview.
It's okay.
I can't even do this interview without even getting emotional.
Understand.
I think that's the only thing people gonna get out this documentary. I think that they're gonna look at me and say, "Wow, all he wants is to be loved. He didn't want no money. He didn't want no fame. He didn't want anything. He just wanted somebody to care about him and stuff like that." I haven't seen the documentary, but I'm pretty sure that's what it is. And. Because that's my whole life story is about the fact that, you know, more like didn't have a father, didn't really have a mother. She wasn't really attentive to us like that and never said, you know, that she loved us or anything like that. And I think a lot of people in the world that lived in that period of time would understand what I'm talking about. It's very difficult when you have a mother, I mean, that worked 3-4 jobs and you never see her and all you do is get yelled at and never have anyone to hug you. But this documentary is going to show, I guess, the fact that, I guess, the pains and trials and tribulations I went through just trying to grow up and try to just be involved in society. It's evident if you look at this documentary. And like I said, I never played the game. I never played the sport for money. And I say that a lot in this documentary. I never played for money. I played because I wanted to play. I loved it. And it just gave me an outlet as far as, like, and I looked at the fact that I'm not living in projects. I'm not dead. I'm not a drug dealer. I'm not this. I'm not that. I don't have a bunch of kids. And I said somebody had their hands on my shoulder as growing up because I could have went the wrong direction and be something that nobody cared about. But for some reason, I think I have a purpose to be here. I mean, literally, a purpose to be here.
What do you think that purpose is?
I really haven't figured that out. I think that, you know, I've fought a lot of demons as being an athlete. One is alcohol. That's right. Something that everyone knows that. So the other one is more like, you know, the shell you see in public is different from the shell you see in private. You know, I always try to tell myself and try to remind myself why I'm still here and why I need to be here. And something I contradict myself a lot, because I show a good light in public and I show a bad person in behind closed door. And people look at me as this great athlete, this great individual that does all these great things around the world, but this other part of the spectrum, this other guy is totally different. You know, it's more like I lie to myself a lot about, I'm a great dad, I love my kids, I love this, I do that, and then I have to go home to myself and sit there and beat myself up because I'm just telling myself all these lies, and I go out in public and sit there and say, okay, great, I'm this persona that I'm not.
Yeah.
And a lot of people are going to see this in a documentary. You know, and I think that people would look at me and say, I'm probably one of the few athletes on the planet that actually come on TV and just spread his whole heart and just on his sleeve. And I just say it the way it is. And people actually like me for that. And I think that's a refreshing for me to do this to the world and say, hey, what you see is what you get. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we all have demons. We all have things we have to handle and take care of. But I think the only demon I really have these days that I pretty much have cleared up a lot of these things up in my life, mm-hmm. I think the only major demon I have right now is trying to convince myself that I'm a good dad. That's the worst one right now for me.
So what are you doing to make sure you're a good dad?
Yeah, man. it's hard for me. For some reason, it's very hard for me to try to break out of that cycle. You know,
do you feel like it's too late? Is that what you're feeling?
I just think it's just one of those things where I never had any want to ever do that for me. And I think sometimes, why am I doing it for somebody else? And knowing the fact that that's my child, that's my wife, or that's my mother, that's my sister, it's like it's hard for me to just gravitate to people like that, that's close to me. And it's difficult, even though inside I love them. And it hurts me when my kids say, it's okay, Dad, you can hug us, you can touch us. And it's hard because it just burns me up. It hurts me so much. And I have to go home and try to reevaluate and try to cleanse my soul and say, yes, you can do this. You can do this. You can do this.
And you can, though.
I just say, you can do this. And I'm like, oh, my God, you know. And I say, okay, I'm going to go do this. And last night, my daughter called me last night. She called me last night, and she said, my ex-wife said, you know, I can do this.
You can do it. Take your time. Just take your time.
You know, this is what I get beat up so much about for myself. She said, Dennis, you know, I don't want anything from you, Dennis. I don't want anything. It's not about me and you. It's about our kids. I said, all right, great. What's wrong now? What do they need? I said, they don't need anything. The only thing they need, they want you to be in their lives. And I'm like, I said, in 18, 19 years, they never said that to me. It's always, you know, something they want. And I just got so detached to that. It's more like, okay, great. What you guys want? Okay, great. And they're
you
not
mean
bad.
Material things.
They're material things. But it's like, they're not bad kids. That's the one thing. They're not even bad kids. It's just I'm so used to hearing it, those things about, okay, can you give me this? Can you give me that for everybody? And it's hard for me to sit there and separate my kids from other people. Because so all these years I've been giving and supplying and on demand and stuff like that, I really haven't had any time to be a father, or even try to be a dad, or try to be anything that's significant to something that's important to me. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm always thinking like, oh, Dennis Rodman, okay, great. I don't think I'm the big shit or the big cheese of the honcho around the world, but it's like I'm so used to being me. There's no one in my life that's helping me out. No one's doing anything to help me or to come and love me. Just actually really just say, okay, great. Let me sit you down, Dennis. I actually like you. I actually love you. I want to actually take care of you. I never had that. Even to this day, it's difficult to really adjust and adapt to that. And she told my ex-wife last night, she told her that she didn't want to see my jerseys or anything about me anymore. And I'm like, wow. And I didn't even react to it. I pretty much looked at it whereas I'm so used to it. I expect that.
But there's a way. There's a way to reconnect with your children. Pick them up and take them for a drive. Don't give them anything. Just take them for a drive.
That's easy for you to say. That's easy for you to say, Jackie.
It is, probably.
You've been a great mother.
Well, you don't know. We all have our ups and downs. It's hard to be a parent.
Let's be a parent.
And I think it's a really hard thing to do when you're not with the person you had the children with and someone who's watching your every move. Believe me, I understand all that. Mm. But it's never too late. It's never too late. They're kids still. They're still young. Yeah. And they probably do. That's probably the only way they know how to communicate. Dad, can you give me this? Dad, can you give me that?
Yeah, I mean,
Don't give up on it.
Even this interview now, you know, I'm supposed to go see her today at 5 o'clock today. We'll see how that's going to work out.
Mm-hmm.
But even then, when I do something like that, go see him, not because I feel bad that I'm not a good dad. And I think I'm a good dad because I provide everything they need, but I'm not a good dad as far as a present dad. You know, even though I live like 10 miles away from him, I don't even see him. But like I said, don't make me a bad person. It's just I'm not adapted to be a parent for some of the reasons because I never had kids with me at no time at all.
Mm-hmm.
I had kids with women. I got four, and I never spent any time with them at all.
Right.
So basically, I was just pretty much a loner and just by myself. My daddy came to me. I didn't know who was my father. I didn't want nothing to do with him. But my kids now want to come and try to be close to me, and I'm trying to go away from them. And I'm trying to figure out if I can actually do this, actually put myself to do this at 58 years old, so if I can sit there and actually forget all my achievement, forget all my awards, forget all the money, forget all the fame, forget all the women, forget everything. Can I actually put all that aside and give just a small portion of my life to just even say, just get to know my kids? That's what I'm fighting with. And then actually meaning when I see them, not just for the time being and then go back and be Dennis Rodman again. Can I be there consistently? And that's the only thing I'm fighting with.
You can. I know you can, because you know what? I believe in you. I do. Because those kids, like, when you do that, you won't even believe the joy that, and you're right. You've never experienced it. Your father abandoned you, your mom kicked you out.
Right.
These kids are saying, let us love you. Let them love you. Give them a chance.
Yeah, you know, it's hard for me to see that through their eyes because when they was growing up, they never saw me play basketball. And all they heard was, oh, your dad's a your dad is gay, your dad's this, your dad does this, he steals, he does this, went to jail, he does this. That's all they heard about me when they was growing up, even though I was one of the most famous person on the planet. So they never heard about the good stuff about me. It's all the bad stuff about me, which wasn't even bad. And it's like, it got to the point that they didn't want to go to school anymore and all that crap. And like, and I try to tell them, you know, it's all, you know, it's my business, it's my job. But they actually kind of shied away from that, from me with that, because they knew it hurt them more than anything because of what I was doing, just going to dress them in drag, doing makeup, wearing wigs and stuff like that. They didn't like me doing that stuff, but it's like, that was my character for me. I was doing it for me.
Mm-hmm.
And
did you like that, you?
I like that. I just like being independent and free. You know, I think when I went to San Antonio, I think they gave me a lot of opportunities. And a lot of people go see this documentary. I went at a young age. I was doing it at a young age. My sisters putting makeup on me, put wigs on me, and dressed me as a woman and stuff like that. And pretty much, I was all like so comfortable being like that because I was so surrounded by that with women, with girls, and this. It was never with boys. Young men, it was never no guys at all. It's always with girls. And for a time, I thought I was gay, you know, because there was no sex involved. There was no interest in girls. It was more like what girls did. I like to do with them.
Mm-hmm.
And when guys come around, I shy away from guys and just trying to distance myself from other guys. I just want to be around girls. And I thought that was just normal for a guy to just hang out with the girls all the time. I didn't ever know it, you know, that, you know, there was gay people in the world back there in the projects. Never knew that. So I thought everyone was equal to me.
I look back on your life. You were homeless for a little while. Your mom said, get a job or you're out. What's it like to be homeless in Dallas? And I'm assuming you were homeless two blocks from where you lived, right?
Oh, yeah. That's
so what funny. Was that like?
That was funny.
Funny?
I mean, it was funny the fact that she kicked me out. She kicked me out and told me that to never come back. She changed the locks. She did all this. She did all that. So I had like a garbage bag full of whatever I had. I left the house and I just sat on the steps down the apartment complex and didn't know where to go. So basically, I just went over to my friend's house. He said, you can stay in the backyard on the couch. And I said, that's cool.
Outside?
Outside on the couch. I said, that's cool, great. You know, so they didn't have enough beds in the house without a sleep on the floor. So it was a couch, so I just slept there a lot. And every day when I wake up, I go to a car wash, try to make some extra money, just have money in my pocket. Or I go to 7-Eleven, try to, you know, fold boxes or throw bottles away and stuff like that, just $5 a day. Mm-hmm. And I just felt like that it was like more like, I didn't even think of that thing. It's more as an abandonment. I didn't even think of it like that. I just think, okay, great. You know, I'm so used to living this life this way, so why not? There's nothing different by living in an apartment or living in the street.
Really?
But it's funny how you think like that when you live like that. It's funny how you think those ways when you live like that, and it doesn't really bother you.
Survival, right?
It's survival mode and stuff like that. So basically, every day I slept outside on the couch, or I go to another friend's house and sleep in three people in the bed. Or I didn't have shoes to wear. I had to borrow shoes. I had to borrow socks, clothes, and stuff like that. It was just a mess. I mean, it was just one of those things where that it is so funny the fact that I was happy. I was happy living like that because I was with my friends. Hmm. And my friends, we hang out and play basketball every day, and I was just happy. I wasn't sad. I never cried about not going home. I never cried about my sister, my mother, so-called father, any one of my relatives I never knew about. I never cried about anybody in my circle. Just the people around me, that my friends and people that I knew, I was so happy being around them just because I had a place to go.
Sure.
And when you see this documentary, you'll see what I'm trying to say. And today it's kind of difficult because I'm thinking about just going to see my daughter later. So right. It's sort of hard for me to get through this.
Yeah.
And I just think that being homeless really has embellished my whole life, because when I was homeless, it was a different world. It was a different world because once you got used to being homeless, I mean, that was your life right there. That was my life then.
For how long? How long did
it? Like, I think I was homeless like, I don't know, a year, 2 years.
Wow.
A year, 2 years, something like that.
In Dallas the whole time, right?
In
Dallas. Were you like 18 or?
I was like, I think it was like 18 after high school. I was like 18 or 20.
But this whole time you're growing, right?
On the streets I'm growing. Completely grown. I was like 5'7", 5'8", maybe 5'6" at the time. I just started growing. Just being in the streets and stuff like that. And it was amazing when I got up to 6'7". It was amazing that I started to pick up the game of basketball. I started to pick the game. I used to love football. And I picked up the game of basketball. And I went to the gym every day. I mean, 8, 9 hours, 10 hours a day, because that's the only outlet I had as far as living in the streets. And I would go there every day, and then all of a sudden, I became pretty good. And I started playing in a summer league team in Dallas. This league team around the whole year, league team.
Outside? Was this outside?
Outside.
Yeah.
And a guy asked me to play on this summer league team one summer. He said, Dennis, I'll let you come play for my team. You know, I said, okay, great. It was like NBA players, but I didn't know about was playing. And Spudwell was in there, Larry Johnson, all these guys. I mean, Karl Malone, all those guys were playing in these summer leagues, but they weren't in college. They was in college. at the time. And I was just coming out of high school at 20 years old. I was like living on the streets. These guys from Louisiana Tech and UNLV, these guys coming out playing. So I was playing on the same team that they was playing on.
Crazy.
And
they're probably going, who the heck is this kid?
Guy, right? So who is this kid going down the court, running and screaming, putting his hand up in there, dunking, doing this stuff like that. So I was just like the outcast because all these guys are like stars in the high schools. You know, all these guys are in college, they're doing great. Here comes a guy that's off the street coming in and having a good time, just loving life to the fullest. So I played the rec for 2 years. And one day, this coach from Southeast Oklahoma State came up. No, matter of fact, I played in the summer league. Then I went to play in a tournament. It was like a mile away from my mother's house. And I played in that game. I won the MVP. And a trophy about this big right here. It was like half, probably the biggest me. And when I left the gym, I had nowhere to go. So basically, I went outside. I sat on the curb with this trophy. And I had a bag with me. And I'm sitting there just figuring out which direction I'm going to go. Who am I going to stay with tonight? What am I going to eat at today? So I looked to my left. This is my left. And there's a woman and a man walking towards me. I didn't know who it was, but I wasn't really paying attention. And all of a sudden, this woman puts a card in my face. And I looked up. It was my mother. And I didn't really jump up at anything. I just pretty much got the card. She said, "Happy birthday." That's pretty much all she said. And she just walked away.
Man.
And she left the card in my hand. I opened it. And she gave me $20. She said, "Even though that you live in the streets, I still love you. If you want to come back home, you can come back home, but you have to get a job." And I said, "Okay, great." And that's arenas and stuff like that. And I'm looking at her as she's walking away with this guy just looking at her. And I'm like, you know, debating, you know. And I just gave in. I said, "Okay, great. I have no place to go. Why not go back and revisit like what I used to have and whatever, has anything changed?" So I go back there, move back in, and all of a sudden, the same scenario at 20 years old. "Well, you're not working, you have to move out." I'm like, "All right, great." And I'm fighting that. I'm like, "Well, it's no jobs available." She said, "Well, go find one." So either way, two days after I was living in the house and she was about to kick me out again, there was a knock on the door. I answered the door, the two white guys at the in the doorway, and they asked, "Is Dennis Rodman here?" I said, "That's me." He said, "All right, we have Ron Weisman and Jack Hayden. We'd like to invite you to a university to try you out for a scholarship." And I'm thinking this is a joke too. I said, "This is bullshit. This is whatever. Am I doing this?" So I said, "Okay, so I can redress." He said, we'll take you up there. We'll bring you right back." So I go up there with these guys and go up there and work out with these two guys. And they said, "You know, you're pretty good." I said, "Well, I don't know. I just play break ball down the street." He said, "You like to come play for us?" I said, "I don't care, whatever. You know, being in a project, that's the way you talk. You know, you don't give a damn about anything." I said, "Okay, yeah, I'll try it." I said, "Okay, great." So we go. So I go into this office, sign a contract intent, 3-year scholarship. So I didn't know what that f***ing meant. I didn't know what the hell that meant, 3-year scholarship. What is that? Yeah. You know, so it's okay, great. So, okay, great. You'll be here for 3 years. You get room and board. You get a dorm room. So I go back the next day on the Greyhound bus. And I said, "Hey, I got a 3-year scholarship." My sister, "That's awesome. That's great." And stuff like that. They was playing ball at the high school. And they was All-Americans, won state championships 4 years in a row. And said, "That's cool. Take it. Go, go, go." And I'm sitting there packing whatever I had, the clothes I had, which they didn't fit. So I had to take whatever I had in a trash bag, roll it up, and toss it on my back. The one thing I said before I left, I said, I'm not coming back here unless I make something of myself. And even then, I didn't know what I was saying, what I was doing. Because, you know, living in a project, you see so much bad. You never see anything good. You know, So I left that day. I left that day to go back to Oklahoma. And, you know, the story's kind of get chopped up a little bit because we don't have that much time.
Yeah.
So, but anyway, right. I go back to Oklahoma, go do my thing, and all of a sudden, I'm All-American first year, All-American second year, All-American third year. And I remember when I made an All-American team in my sophomore year, and people were saying, oh, my God, congratulations, Dennis, congratulations. Oh, my God, you made All-American. We never had an All-American here in, like, 50 years. Okay, and I'm asking someone to me, I said, on my left ear, I said, what's an All-American? I didn't know what the hell All-American was. What's All-American? I said, all right, great. He said, you're a good player around the world. I mean, around the United States. All right, great. Didn't know anything about All-American. So my junior year, I'm All-American again, 26, 27, and 16. 28 points and 15, 16 rebounds. I'm All-American 3 years in a row. So basically, I'm like, I'm doing something good. And all of a sudden now, this is when I started getting involved with white women. I get involved with white women. That's a curse of me right now. I'm back there right now.
I don't think we can blame white women.
Right, I'm just saying, I got involved with white women because black girls back then didn't like me.
Okay.
So they didn't like me because But either way, like I said, you know, I'm not, it's like, okay, great. I got involved with white women and a couple of black girls. Mm-hmm. That's when I started to have sex at that time, like at 22, 23 years old in college and stuff like that. And all of a sudden, now you're the big man on campus.
Right.
But those years was it was one of those experiences that, you know, I never take back. You know, and you got racial tension down there. You got people calling you names. You got people doing this.
Yeah,
blah, blah, blah. They don't want you here because you're black, or if you date a white girl, you can get your hair shot off, or you can get your hair cut off. I dealt with all this stuff like that for 3 years in Oklahoma. 3 years, but it was just at a time when things wasn't correct like they are today.
Sure.
So, and I understand that because I lived it in the 60s.
Right.
So I lived in the 60s, I saw all that. But I never took that as a negative for me to keep moving forward.
I understand, yeah.
You know, they want to shoot me, they want to do this, they want to damn me, stuff like that. I never took it to heart. And so basically, those years in Southeast Oklahoma just propelled me pretty much to leap into the NBA. You know, with a blindfold on, pretty much. I love to work. I love to have a good time. I love to just play basketball. But when I went to the NBA, it was different because I was so green behind the ears. I'm just, my eyes are wide open like a deer. Forget the car, forget the truck, just keep going. And more like I just wanted to play, jump, 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 rah, rah, rah. And that was all I wanted to do. And
And you meet Chuck Daly.
I mean Chuck Daly. Wow, what a great man, right?
Right. That's
great man.
What did he mean to you, Chuck Daly?
He was more like, he was just, I think Chuck Daly felt so attached to me because I was so young in the mind. But so energetic as far as life.
Mm-hmm.
I think Chuck Daly gravitated to me because I didn't know too much about anything when I went to Detroit. You know, the farthest I went from Dallas was like Oklahoma. I didn't know any other state besides Dallas or Oklahoma. And when I got to Detroit, he just embraced me like right away because he knew I was just so like lost. But he knew that I wanted to play basketball. He saw that ability in me to say, this guy want to play basketball. He don't know anything about life, but I could teach him. But he just want to play basketball. That's all he wants to do. I think once he saw me play and when we practiced, I think he knew that he had something special. I think the fact that from leaving James Rich in Oklahoma and then coming to the NBA and meeting Chuck Daly was the best thing for me, from moving from Oklahoma to Detroit, meeting a guy like Chuck Daly. Then me going from college to L.A.
Right.
So L.A. Right. Oh my God, if I went from college to L.A., I probably wouldn't be here today.
I agree with that.
I probably won't be here today at all.
go to Chuck Daly's house for Christmas and stuff, right? Christmas stuff. So what's it like? What's Christmas like with the Dalys?
With the Dalys, I mean, the first thing they teach you, do not come in the house with your shoes on. And I'm like, okay, great. I asked him, I said, why not? He said, well, it's white carpet. It's all white carpet. Everything's white here. You know, we don't want to damage anything. So, but inside their home, it's more like just being, like, I was with the family in Oklahoma, just like that. It was like, I never left home. You know, they treat me like that, like one of their own. And they look at me as a black person. They look at me as a black athlete. They look at me as, hey, how you doing? What's going on? You need anything? Da da da. And
safe, right?
Yeah, it was very safe there. I mean, very comfortable for me to be there. And stuff like that, because when I'm alone in my apartment and there's nobody there to be with me, I always call Chuck Daly or Isaiah Thomas. Stuff like that, because I had nobody with me.
Right. So what did you get Chuck Daly for Christmas?
Well, let me see what I got Chuck Daly for Christmas. Let's see. I was making $100,000 back then.
Isn't that funny, right?
That's what I think that's about those days, right?
Yep.
We made $100,000 back then, and half of that's going to taxes, and portion that's going to your lawyers, your agent, and your rent. And basically, you have nothing. I was pretty much broke, you know, first couple of years in the league. I didn't have any money. I had to go work, like, summer jobs and stuff like
really?
That. Yeah, I mean, and it's kind of funny to look at it like that, $100,000 back then for, like, 9 months of your life. Compare when people can go to McDonald's and make $100,000 at McDonald's now. Wow, okay, great. But now guys are making $100,000 maybe in 5 minutes or an
true.
Hour.
Right. It's
and but it's like I really have didn't really get any Christmas gifts or even give any gifts out because there was no money there to give out.
So it's just to be there with them.
Just to be with this. They just said, come to Christmas, come on Thanksgiving, come this, come that. Mm. And I was always there and I was always grateful because they wanted me a part of it. So I was really grateful for the Dalys.
So, like, the whole Detroit thing explodes. Your career explodes.
It explodes.
You win championships. It did it happen too fast almost, or?
No, I think what really exploded for me in Detroit is, like, I was there. I was immature mentally-wise, but I was mature enough to play the game of basketball. I had the energy and the desire and the love and the heart to play basketball, and people loved that. And I think people saw that in Detroit that I was just out there like, yes, I want to play basketball. And I think what changed my whole life is the fact that Isaiah Thomas came to me one day. We played a game in L.A. at the Forum, and I was at half court just bending down, and Isaiah pulled me up and said, and hit me in the chest so damn hard. He said, you know, Dennis, this is not a game. This is not a joke. We want to win a championship. You got to get your act together, get your ass together, and get your head focused. You can't keep going out with John Sally. You can't do this all the goddamn time. You got to do this. You got to do your job. We want to win. And I think that right there changed my whole perspective on the NBA because I never knew anything about the NBA lifestyle. I just thought it was just like a one big playground.
Right.
And so that opportunity right there, when he did that to me, changed my whole life about the game of basketball.
So I don't know if you've seen this in the film, but they ask Isaiah about you when things were going bad, and he tears up in the film.
That's funny. Isaiah was there for me from day one. I mean, he looked at me as like a 12-year-old child because I saw my mentality and my mind was like that because I didn't know how to do anything for myself. And if I had a scratch on me, I'd go and call him, and he said, what's wrong? I said, my leg hurt. I don't know what to do with this and stuff like that. He'll jump out of bed 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, come over and take care of me, or he'll say he'll take me to a doctor if I had something. If I had a cyst on my leg, he'd say, you know what, we'll take you to the doctor right now. And it's nothing that he wouldn't do for me back then because he looked at me the same way like I was a little child, just like this coming into this system as a new toy. I'm thinking, okay, great, I'm gonna play with this toy, you know, before I get bored. Yeah, that's how he looked at me, but he wanted to take care of me, put me on his umbrella, and say, I'm going to take care of you. Understand, follow my lead. And people are going to realize the fact that it's like, that's the way I was back then in those days. You know, I was just pretty much lost, but I was lost in happiness, pretty much in my eyes. Going from the projects to the NBA.
Sure.
You know, I think when I exploded in the NBA, I think it was the first championship. You know, the first championship that we won, and they asked me to speak at the Palace. I couldn't even talk. I mean, like I did today, I can't even talk.
I was there.
You was there. I couldn't even say anything. I didn't know what to say, but I was so happy. And I felt like when you hear the applause, the emotion and stuff like that, it hits you, because I think that people love me because of those actions when I do right there, show my emotion, because I really care, the fact that they actually care about me. And those emotions come out so much, because it's hard for me to adapt to that. But when I hear it and I see it and people actually genuinely like me, I give it back. And for me to sit there and try to talk, I just couldn't do it. And I think you saw Isaiah, the first person to come up and hug me up there. And it's like, it's okay. It's okay.
Right.
I said, I know what I'm going to say, man. These people, I didn't want to let people down, and they like me. And
it's nice to have people like you, isn't it?
Yeah, it's hard to adapt to that. And like when I won a defensive player of the year, I cried because of that. And people said, why are you crying? I said, because I wanted it so bad. And I'm like, well, I worked my ass off to do it.
Right.
And I'm so used to working on the farm, get up at 5:30 in the morning, and we're working out three times a day in southeastern Oklahoma. Every day I worked, and nothing came about it. And then once I won something, I couldn't believe I did it. And probably didn't realize what I was doing, but I realized I did some achievement. And I got an award for it. I'm like, yay, like getting a medal in high school.
Right.
You know, so it's like that. I get it. And it feels so good. And I think that every time I get anything that come my way, anything that has to do with me, it's in the NBA, you always see me get emotional about it.
Right.
You know, like I don't deserve it.
That's how you feel, huh?
That's how I feel. I don't deserve it, because it's like, wow, it's other people out there. There's other people. And I talk about other people besides me.
You know? Yeah, but you worked for it.
Yeah, I worked for it.
That's what people don't know. A lot of people thought, oh, he was just a natural athlete. They had no idea how hard you worked.
Nah, I worked my ass off. But I put other people in front of me, you know.
Right.
And stuff like that. And this has been a really weird journey for me.
Yeah,
weird journey. I mean, and when people see this documentary, it's 30 for 30, they're gonna get what I'm trying to say. I can't do a good job today because I got something about my daughter. I'm gonna say to her later on. So how to try to fix that?
It's more important.
But I'm saying, but this is good for people to understand before they see the documentary. Where I think people gonna get out the fact, out of the documentary, you're gonna see that what you said earlier, that all I want to do is give you a hug, because it seems like you've never been loved before.
Yeah.
And I think people gonna get this. When they leave the theater, when they leave their homes and stuff like that, the young kids today are going to have to say, I want to go give him a hug. So I don't even know him, but
right.
I want to give him a hug. And I'm like, wow.
Right.
You know, so I think that right there would be more to me when people are just, they want to give me a hug? Great, that's cool. I'd rather take that than like give me an autograph.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Just give me a picture. I'd rather just give me a hug. Okay, thank you.
More
genuine like that. So it's like, so I'm more comfortable with that than anything in the world. And I think this game hasn't, this NBA lifestyle has not really damaged me too much for me not to appreciate what love is all about. I think I know what it is, but I don't know how to do it. I don't know what to do about it.
Mm-hmm.
But I know what it is, but I don't know how to do it.
Okay.
But I think this game has taught me so much to understand that, you know, without the game, you'd need something else to fall back on besides, you know, keeping your life on this path of being an athlete. There's more besides being an athlete after you retire. Something else has to be in a good path for you to lead your life in the right direction.
And do you struggle with that a little bit, to find what that path is?
Oh, yeah.
I think so, right?
I find it all the time. That I just, like, you know, sometimes when I walk out, I always say, which way am I going?
Yeah. What am I doing today?
What am I doing today? I'm lost now because I ain't got basketball to wake up to. I don't have a job to go to. I don't have there's nothing really there for me. No.
So what about the NBA? I know you've contacted some teams, right, about getting involved with teams. Am I right?
Yeah.
So, like, which teams have you tried to talk with? What are you hoping to do?
Well, it's not I'm hoping to do anything. I just want people to know that, you know, if you want me to come and consult some of the players today to try to keep their mind frames in a situation where they can keep their mind on their business instead of like, you know, besides other things, besides money, clothes, this. When you, what an athlete should be depending on right now, I mean, the athlete should be focusing on is winning ball games. And I want to show the people that if they hire me, is that the fact that I'm very consistent, I'm very loyal, I'm very honest, I'm very pure and caring about the individual and what I do. I'm like that. Mm-hmm. I'm trustworthy. And I want to show people that, hey, you know, like, try me out a little bit because I'm pretty good with people and stuff like that.
You're a pretty good player, too. I mean, a pretty good player.
I see. I don't always talk about me as a basketball player. I talk about everybody else.
Right.
I just want people to understand, you know, if you want some advice or they want me to come to the organization and say, okay, great, how are you as a consultant?
Mm-hmm. So could you work with, like, you know, I'm going to argue you were the greatest rebounder that ever lived.
No, come on. You've been around Bill Russell a lot.
I have, but Bill Russell was a different kind of rebounder.
Well, no,
the game was different then. Everybody missed all the time, so there were more rebounds.
Oh, okay.
That's the other thing.
Right, right.
But you're one of the greatest rebounders. We'll say one of the greatest rebounders ever.
One.
When you watch the game today, who catches your eye? Like, who do you look at and say, wow, that's, I like the way he does things?
Well, I don't even watch the NBA too much
today.
I don't. I mean, my son does. I mean, he's like 6'8". He goes to Washington State. Mm-hmm. And I don't watch the NBA too much. You know,
yeah.
I watch it when my kids do. When my son's around, I watch it with him. But and my friends around.
Yeah.
That we go to sports, but I watch it. But the game is exciting for kids today.
Yeah.
They love those energetic players, LeBron, Steph Curry, Harden, everybody's involved. So they love those guys. So I think the NBA is doing a great job to parlay the teams now.
Yeah.
And a couple of years ago, it was like kind of uneven. You know, it's all about Golden State, but now they have like five or six other teams can win now.
Right.
So I think it's good for the league now. From now, everyone can pay attention again, so it's more competitive.
So you play with Michael.
Oh, yeah.
And in the film, and I think you're right, you said there was a time when you were probably more famous than Michael. That's really saying something.
That was funny. I haven't seen that part, but I think that when Michael sees that little clip right there, I think Michael's going to get a laugh out of that. He'll say, he's probably right. He's gonna say he's probably right because every 1 year in Chicago he was blown up and stuff like that. Everybody knew me, but they didn't know this other guy that can have basketball and entertainment at the same time and on a nutshell. I was like, wow. But I think that I was a good fit for Chicago. Michael approved it. Scottie approved it. Phil Jackson approved it. I think that Michael embraced me with open arms, Scotty. So, but I said that comment, the fact that every time I ride downtown, and I was, I'd be listening to the radio, and when I get to a certain section in downtown on the 94, they'll give a traffic report. The traffic report, and they said, when you get to 94 and Arden, there's gonna be a delay there because there's Dennis Rodman billboard right there on the exit, and people are stopping by and taking pictures. And I looked at the radio. I said, "What?" So I like really. And he kept saying it over and over. I said, "Oh, great." So I'm driving down the highway 94. It was a traffic jam. So I go to the UV lane, and next thing you know, I'm like, and people are outside their cars on the freeway taking pictures of my face with green hair. And I knew that sign existed. I passed by it every day. And I'm like, that's me. It's like, and the people outside, out their cars, on the rails, taking pictures of this, of me. And
pretty
I'm
cool.
Like, wow, this is crazy. And it was like, before that my picture was there, it was Michael and Scotty. And then when I got there, it was Michael, Scotty, and Dennis. And then a couple months, it became just me. And I'm like, wow, man. You know, I didn't even think of the time that it was like, man, you bigger than Michael, huh? You bigger than Michael. I said in Chicago. I said, well, you know, that 1 year maybe 6 months I was bigger, but other than that, no, it was more like I didn't take it that way, but I said it, yes, I did. I was bigger than Michael for a minute.
Is he the greatest player you've ever seen?
I think that he's probably the greatest player, greatest individual in the sport of basketball.
I agree.
I mean, I think him, Scotty, Isaiah, Magic, Bird, Charles Barkley, just to name a few, Akeem Olajuwon, David Robinson. I mean, I can go on and on, but it's like Michael epitomized the fact that he didn't care what it took. He's going to win. I think he showed that his first year in the league. He came out like, what? Mm-hmm. And he was pretty much a solo act in Chicago. Nobody knew how to handle Michael. So Michael was just by himself. And I think that the people around him was more like here and it moved away. It was more like when you see him and the way he was like so graceful with the ball. So like when he shot, he looked good. When he dunked, he looked great. When he did a layup, it was more like spectacular because he had to put a twist to it. And it's like, wow, this guy here. Yeah. I mean, and then when I got to the team, it was more like, okay, great. This guy's still great. He's still awesome. He still want to win. He still got the passion and the love and stuff like that. And I looked at him and I said, well, this guy, I can play for him. Then I looked at my right shoulder. Guess who's next beside me? Scottie Pippen.
Pretty cool.
That guy right there. They have to be the best 1-2 punch ever. In my book. The 1-2 punch ever. Mm-hmm. Because once Scottie learned how to play the position, his role with Michael, I just thought they was the best tandem ever. I thought Joe Dumars and Isaiah was, but these two guys here, man, they revolutionized the point forward.
Right.
6'6 and 6'8, 6'9.
Yeah, they were special.
And Scottie was like so, he was just smooth as hell. He was just whatever. I mean, he was just like jello. Like, what the hell, man? I mean, he's coming down doing this, doing that. Mike is doing this, doing that. I'm coming down just following the lead and just watching me clapping the whole time. Like, yay, I got two great players behind me.
That's great.
So I can win more championships.
You're funny. I just want to know what makes Dennis Rodman happy today. Today. What makes you happy?
What makes me happy, Jackie? What makes me happy? People always want to hear that question now. What makes you happy, Dennis? That was the time, Jackie, you know, people don't know this story. I'm surprised this didn't get in a documentary. That was the time I used to call you late at night.
Yes, you did.
I used to call you late at night. People don't really know this. Guys, I used to call her late at night with her husband and da da da. I'm like, you know, same thing, but nobody knows that me and her have been friends for a long time. And you actually helped me a lot in those days. You helped me a lot. People don't know this either. And when I was down, when I was out, when I was like, you know, depressed or lonely, you were always there. You know, he was always there for me to pick up the phone when you was tired or whatever. You was had a long day. You were always there for me and picked up the phone. I said, wow. And you always said, whatever you need, whatever any time of the day, when you're lonely, when you're sad, just call me. I'll be there for you. And you've been there the whole time. Even today, when you have something more important to do than to fly here in this beautiful sunshine weather in California, you came here out of your own busy schedule to even do this interview for me. And that shows a lot for me, that the fact that you still, after 30 years, you still have the love for me. And that's what I was been trying to talk about in this whole interview, is that that's the thing I miss the most, the fact that when I see people like you, I see, if I saw Chuck the other day, that right there just brings, just opened me up and said, wow, they're back. Yeah. This is the love I'm talking about right here. And people don't understand that, you know, it takes time to actually embrace someone in your life. Yes. And when you haven't seen them in a long time, it just opens more love and more emotion and say, wow, I can't believe you're back. And that's a great story, you know. When I first talked to you a couple of weeks ago, and I was getting emotional. I said, wow, that's my friend. I remember when she used to call me. I used to talk to her late night. She helped me out. And I'm like, wow, she still like me? That's the first thing I say. Is she still like me? You know, da-da-da. Because I haven't talked to her in a long time. And I was just so happy after I got off the phone with you. And I called Darren and I said, man, that girl, she used to be so cool to me. She's so awesome, man. How'd you do that? How'd you get this interview for me? Stuff like that. I was so like a kid. I heard that you were going to do this interview. Because it's just, like I said, no better person than you that I want to do an interview with. And I was shocked that you did this. And I could have had anybody in the world, but you jumped to it. I said, yes, yes. So I appreciate you doing this, spending the time with me today. And I want to ask you one thing before we
okay, fair enough.
I want to ask one thing.
You can.
I'm let the whole world, the ESPN world, know about Jackie McMullen.
They don't care.
I want everyone to know this, because this is the first time I ever say this. I want Jackie McMullen to write my book, my next book, not my last book, my next book, about the trials and tribulations and the good and the bad about Dennis Rodman and North Korea.
All right.
I want her to write that book for me, and I want her to go to North Korea and experience that relationship that I have with Kim Jong-un, and she bring it back and show the side of that country and our country. And I want her to write that book and show my experience about Dennis Rodman. And I want to write that book. It's going to be a bestseller, I guarantee you that. All right? So no basketball involved. It's all life.
Life is good. All right, Dennis, thank you. 30 for 30.
Right, 30 for 30.
So, for better or for worse.
That's a good title, right?
It is.
Better for worse.
I like the better Dennis Rodman, not the worst one.
The worst one? Believe it, so after this, you're going to Connecticut to the Hall of Fame?
I'm going to Connecticut to Bristol.
You're going to Bristol?
Yeah.
You're going to the headquarters, huh?
Yeah.
The headquarters.
Mothership?
Never been there. Invite me. Invite me to headquarters.
Done.
All right.
Great.